You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie is in Europe right now, and so he will not be with us for our normal brunch with Bernie hour, but he sends his regards, and we'll be back next week. And not as in the meantime, but that sounds terrible, but I'm honored to welcome Senator Sherrod Brown, and I'm honored to welcome Sherrod Brown, Senator Sherrod Brown, the senator from the great state of Ohio, one of Bernie's colleagues and another great progressive in the United States Senate, to the program. Senator Brown, welcome.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Great to have you with us.
It's fun to be in your studio when we do it, but not today, but other days.
Well, I'm glad you like it. It's kind of funky, but it's, you know, it's a radio studio that's simulcast on TV.
People knew how palatial it was. They would have a different view of this progressive, Mr. Hartman.
Indeed.
It's beautiful. It overlooks the Taj Mahal. I mean, it almost is a Taj Mahal, isn't it?
Well, and not only that, we own it. That's the nice thing, I guess. So.
All right.
You know, it's that Mitt Romney, we built it, you know, right? We actually did. Some of the equipment here started in my living room in Vermont. But in any case, speaking of building it, you've got this plan for a national network for manufacturing innovation, jobs, and this sort of thing. Tell us about this.
Well, we know a number of things. We know that to create wealth, you either grow it, you make it, or you pull it out of the ground. And we don't do as well making things as we used to as a nation. We are a very productive manufacturing workforce. We are, but not nearly as many people work, and we don't make nearly as much in this country. We lost 5 million manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2010. But since the auto rescue, we've grown back about 500,000 of those jobs, and we need to do manufacturing, the kind of advanced manufacturing, doesn't mean we don't turn our backs on traditional manufacturing, but do the kind of advanced manufacturing we need to do. We need a bit more of a partnership between the federal government, local governments, and business and labor and universities, and we've taken some steps. At Youngstown, Ohio, the first place in the country to have something like this, called National Additive Manufacturing Innovation, is working with Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh and Case Western in Cleveland and Youngstown State in Youngstown and local businesses and community colleges, to begin. It's sort of a teaching hospital model where there's sort of a specialty that grows out of that in the institution, in the Manufacturing Innovation Center, and then entrepreneurs grow out of that and create the kind of jobs that give people a shot at the middle class.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a great thing. Steve Keen is a professor of economics in Australia, Western Australian University, and he's sort of a regular on our program. And earlier in the week, he and I were talking about how there's basically these three things that have to be in balance in a macro economy, you know, the 60,000-foot view of an economy. One is the public sector, whether it's in debt or whether it's in surplus, the government sector. The second is the private sector, whether it's in debt or in surplus and how it's doing. And the third is the balance of payments sector, which is basically the trade debt plus or minus any deals that we have with other countries, investments we have abroad, things like that bring money in or cause money to go out. And he made the point that the reason why Japan is relatively unaffected by a debt to GDP ratio of over 200%, and China is flirting with numbers at or around that, maybe vastly more than that. They're quite opaque, but doing just fine, thank you very much. Is because these three numbers have to be in balance. That when you have a national debt of $16 trillion, that literally means that there's $16 trillion in the private sector that's in savings invested in that debt. So there's it's like double entry bookkeeping. But the plus or minus part is the trade deficit or surplus. And since the Reagan administration, we've had about a $9 trillion trade deficit in the United States since we really started seriously flirting with global free trade. And that those countries that have a surplus, like Japan and China, are able to run huge deficits without it affecting them. In fact, arguably to their benefit rather than their detriment. They have all kinds of elbow room for government to do things that can further enhance that. How come we never hear a conversation about our trade debt and deficit?
Well, it's interesting. We haven't Partly because, that's a very good question. I mean, I'm troubled by that and have been sort of puzzled by that over the years. I remember during the Ross Perot campaigns, and he's not a guy I normally would use as a model in much of anything in terms of his policies, his political thought and policies, but he talked about sort of the twin deficits we faced in the early 90s, budget deficit and trade deficit. And we know what that means. It means that jobs, when you have, and I my focus was always more, I mean, on both, but always more on the trade deficit. When you have, if you're selling $1 billion more than you're bringing in, two countries are selling more than they're bringing in, or are bringing in more than, I'm sorry, that are you know, exporting $1 billion less than they're importing, they end up, it clearly translates into jobs. George Bush the first said that $1 billion trade deficit is about 13,000, translates into about 13,000 jobs. And you multiply that out to our hundreds of billions of dollars in trade deficit, and it's clear that if you're not selling enough and you're buying a lot more, that over time you've got a problem. And as you point out, as that professor points out, it means what conservatives are always saying when they talk about the budget deficit, only that half of it, not the trade deficit, that we're paying, that the Chinese are, we're borrowing money from China to pay this trade deficit, which in some sense, in many senses, we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And running a budget surplus actually would give us the ability to not so much worry about a budget deficit, because, you know, it all has to do with the economy, you know, in this kind of macro sense, without super getting wonky on economics here. How can we change that dialogue? I know you talk about the trade budget deficit and the trade and the need for a trade surplus and how we can bring about a trade deficit. Is there any kind of a caucus for this in Congress? Is there?
There's not really any kind of a caucus for it. There's a group of us that talk about it. There's a larger group in the House. When I was in the House until 2006, there were a couple of times when we almost defeated trade agreements because a coalition of some pretty conservative Republicans that might have opposed, that were sort of more isolationist in nature. Mm-hmm. Not that I didn't like kind of their approach. I liked where they ended up. And then there was a group of progressives and a group of people that just understood that our country gets poorer when we don't make things. Okay. And I think you're seeing they're seeing a renewed interest and focus in manufacturing in the Senate now. I don't think people see it in terms of trade policy as much as they should. But there is, I think you notice when you're buying things, people, they're trumpeting more made in America when it is. There are some policies in this country more that way coming out of Congress, but more tokenism than something for real. But I've always found the country has been in a different place from trade than Congress. I remember years ago, Trent Lott said, Republican, very pro-free trade leader in the Senate from Mississippi, he said, we have to pass trade agreements in odd numbered years. We can't ever pass them in even numbered years because of the elections, which if that doesn't tell you something.
That should be a huge warning. I think the average American is can remember, most people are old enough to remember a time when most goods bought in America were actually made in America, and that's certainly not the case now. And people know that there's something just intrinsically, intuitively wrong with that. We have a little less than a minute left.
It's all kind of come at the same time. It happened, you'd said the Reagan years, and it was beginning to happen before that. 1973, you're right about that, when it accelerated. 1973, if you look from 73 on since then, workers have continued to be more productive. We had a trade surplus prior to 73, so the trade deficits actually started in 73, partly because of oil, but other things. Our workers have been more and more productive. Profits have generally been up, and wages have been stagnant or worse. That's partly because of the decline of unionism, trade unions, but it's other things too. But that's really been the time that we've not grown this economy, and with the economy growing, we've not spread it around to those who are the most productive, the workers.
Yeah, very, very well said. Senator Sherrod Brown, brown.senate.gov is his website, and sherrodbrown.com as well. Thank you, sir.
Glad to be back. Good to be back. Thanks.
Great to have you with us. Thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls after the break. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Jeff?
Good. Hey, I've been enjoying your show for years. You converted me from conservatism.
Uh-oh.
Maybe several years back, and I got to tell you, I'm half happy about it and half disappointed because I used to get along with my family.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's okay. Not your fault. Okay. I just wanted to share with you just a humorous story that unfortunately happens to me way too much.
Mm-hmm.
This morning I found myself being interrupted by a guy at a lunch counter. I was having a cordial political conversation. And I got interrupted by a very hard right-wing guy who proceeded to kind of start yelling at me.
Mm-hmm.
Only to discover through the process of his ranting about freeloaders and people that mooch off the government and stuff like that, that he shut down his business to go on Social Security disability on purpose.
Oh, really?
And for the first time in a long time, I was stymied. And I even said to the guy, and I probably was more rude than I needed to be, I said, sir, I'm sorry, I don't know how to argue with somebody who is, you know,
condemning what he does
and complaining about people that mooch off the government. I said, I mean, I guess if you were a black white supremacist, you know, then that would be maybe something to buy. But I said, quite frankly, I don't know how to argue with you, sir.
Yeah. What do you say?
Yeah. Well, he just continued. He went on with the talking points. And at some point, I just kind of said, listen, I listened to the Sean Hannity show, too, so I'm already familiar with all your opinions.
Yeah.
And then I actually said, you're welcome for the breakfast that I'm paying for.
Oh, yeah. You can pick it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have another 30 seconds, I got another interesting anecdote for
sure,
you.
Sure. Go for it.
I'm a financial advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a week that goes by that some Republican baby boomer doesn't sit in my office and ask me how they can hide $200,000 to $500,000 worth of their assets,
right,
so that if they ever needed nursing care, they could get the government to pay for it.
Oh, in other words, because in order to get Medicaid to pay for your nursing care, you have to be broke. We had, in the case of my mother, we had to basically, you know, sell off all of my dad's assets, use all that money to pay for her health care up until that point. And had she had to go, she lived with my brother until she died. But if she'd had to go into a nursing home, we would have had to basically completely bankrupt my dad's estate, which and there wasn't that. You know, he worked in a tool and die shop all his life, but there was something there. But you have to become poor in order to become eligible for this. And so you've got people coming in saying, you know, I got a $200,000 house that's paid off. I want to be able to, be taken care of in old age, but not have to go through that getting poor thing first. Is that right?
Exactly. I want my kids to have my wealth, and I want to have the government benefit.
Right.
And I simultaneously hate it when the government swells because there are too many people taking benefits they don't deserve.
Right. That's bizarre. By the way, the only way that I know of to do something like that is you can give a gift to your kids of, what is it, 10 grand a year?
Yeah, that's a piece of a
tax-free,
much more complicated,
yeah,
complicated process. But.
So you do that every year to each one of your children until you run out of money. But people who have the mentality that you're talking about, I don't think they want to run out of money. They don't.
That's exactly, you know.
Yeah, they just want
that benefit.
They want to be able to control it. Amazing. Jeff, thanks a lot for sharing with us. I appreciate the call, and good on you. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to congratulate the Senator Brown on the Ohio State University. I think it was Dr. Len Sheepan, who's a chemical engineer, who figured out a way to perfect the clean coal process.
Clean coal?
Yeah. They take the coal, put it in a chamber with iron oxide, which is the solid fuel that we use in the space shuttle, iron oxide.
Iron oxide is a fancy way of saying rust.
Okay. But the point
is... Well, it
is.
I mean, if you oxidize iron, it turns red and it's called rust.
Right, exactly. But in essence, what you do is it produces zero pollution, no CO2, and the byproducts are coal ash, water, and iron.
Yeah, well, coal ash is pretty nasty stuff. It is radioactive. It's deadly toxic. There are oceans of it around the United States. So I would not call that clean coal. There is clean coal is an oxymoron, Steve. There is no such thing. Dustin in Maryland Heights, Missouri. Hey, Dustin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I got to stop watching your show. You get me really obsessed with particular topics. For about a month, I read every journal article, every book I could find on the Second Amendment. Now you got me hooked on the modern monetary theory. And it's very,
that's great.
Very fascinating, but it's very complex. I'm kind of struggling to get my head around it.
Yeah.
What would you recommend as far as like some sites or books to really understand the concept?
I read, I buried myself in it for several days when I first discovered it, and read a lot of wonky blogs and a couple of books and lots of there's a couple of actually very good blogs on it. But the person who is going to be a guest on our program on Monday, actually, we're going to have her on, Stephanie Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N, does an absolutely brilliant job of breaking modern monetary theory down to ways that a person who's not an economist, you know, without using wonky language, can understand. And there are, if you just Google her name or DuckDuckGo, my preferred search engine, doesn't track you and feed your information to advertising companies. But if you go to
from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, is that the
she's out of someplace in the Midwest. That would make sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you search on her name and then say give me videos for Stephanie Kelton, the top six or seven that pop up, one of them is a speech that she gave down in Australia with Steve Keen, who was on our program earlier this week. Which was just, you know, a brilliant analysis, and she was talking about the origins of money and things like that. Another one is an hour-long presentation that she gave to a, as I recall, it was a college class, and it was kind of an overview of MMT. Stephanie Kelton has done and then there's a couple that are speeches that she's given to the general public where she really makes it accessible. So I would recommend starting by watching the videos of her if you're comfortable with that and your computer will accommodate the bandwidth. And as far as the blogs go, I have not spent so much time on them that I have them memorized. I think I know what they are, but if I get them wrong, I don't want to say it on the air, so I'll get back with you on that, Dustin. Dustin, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As far as books on modern monetary theory, I have not yet found one that I could give to, you know, a friend or relative who doesn't really know economics. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Anything Goes Friday. So, you know, if you want to talk about UFOs, I'm going to, at some point here, I want to talk about Mercury retrograde. Somebody in the chat room a couple days ago said, "Does Tom believe in astrology?" And I went in and said, "I'm very wary about Mercury retrograde, but I'm not sure I believe in astrology," which seems like an interesting contradiction. I'll share why. And although I'm, you know, there may be something to it, I'll share a story about that too. And also, we've got a very interesting pigeon alert for you today. But first, Sammy in Hagerville, Kentucky. Sammy, you're a believer in clean coal?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't understand why you don't think coal was clean.
Clean because it's dirty.
And what means?
Well, you know, first of all,
Just because it comes out of the ground, it's dirty?
No. There's a lot of things come out of the ground that aren't dirty. Carrots. It's dirty because when you burn it, first of all, there's lots of stuff that goes into the atmosphere that shouldn't be in the atmosphere. And secondly, there's a lot of residue left over called fly ash that will kill you, that is poison. So, you know, until you can show me a method that you can burn coal and not have fly ash left over and not have carbon dioxide and sulfides and radioactive actinides and all this other kind of mercury going to the atmosphere, I'm not going to believe that there's such a thing as clean coal.
Well, the previous caller was telling you about how it burns with no CO2. I mean,
well, CO2 is not my, you know, CO2 with or without CO2 is not my definition of whether something is clean or not. I mean, if that's the case, then you could, first of all, nobody's doing it, so I don't think it's commercially viable. Secondly, if simply putting something in the presence of rust is going to take carbon dioxide out of it, which I'm very skeptical of, we could put piles of rust in the smokestacks of our gas-fired power plants because, you know, their principal exhaust is carbon dioxide. That would be cool. I mean, my understanding is that carbon dioxide sequestration, the process of pulling carbon dioxide out of a gaseous form and turning it into a solid form, is fairly complex and fairly expensive, which is why nobody's doing it. We don't even do it with our cars with catalytic converters. They're not designed to take out CO2. They're not designed to catalyze or to break down some of the exhaust high fractions, high petroleum fractions, high hydrocarbon fractions that are the most carcinogen, that are the most carcinogenic and the most toxic to us and to our atmosphere. But you know, please, if you can point to any place in the country where they are burning coal and there's nothing going into the air and there's nothing left over afterwards, I will publicly on the air, bow down to you.
I don't know of anything that's not left over, but I do know there's a way without gases.
That's commercially viable?
Ohio right now.
That's commercially viable?
No, it's not commercial. They just come out with it.
Yeah, well, see, it is possible to create a Higgs boson particle, It's just takes a $3 trillion superhadron collider somewhere in Switzerland. And, just because something's possible doesn't mean that, just because it's possible to burn coal in a way that doesn't produce carbon dioxide does not mean that it's ever going to be done. And we've got a really serious problem right now. Ask anybody in the path of Hurricane Sandy. We've got a really serious problem right now with too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is warming up our atmosphere. So we've got now 5% more moisture in our atmosphere than we had 30 years ago, or for the last, say, 170,000 years, the entire history of the human race. And that 5% extra moisture is causing our storms to be more violent. It's causing our hots to be hotter, our colds to be colder, our winds to be windier. We got some serious problems here, and it's being caused by burning fossil fuels. It's not just coal. Coal, oil, natural gas, right across the board, all three of them. We have alternatives. We have enough wind in this country to power the entire country. We have enough sun in this country to power the entire country. Germany is the cloudiest country in all of Europe, and yet they have more solar power per capita than pretty much any place else in the world. China is rapidly outdistancing us in the use of both wind and solar power. It's like, when are we going to wake up and get smart about this? So we should be leaving the coal in the ground, frankly, and figuring out ways for people in coal country, like I'm guessing you are in Hager Hill, Kentucky, for people in coal country to make use of all that sun that's falling on the ground, all that wind that's blowing over the top. Let's come up with free energy, free electricity, and then bring our jobs back home and start doing some manufacturing in this country. Does that work for you, Sammy?
Well, that would work if it all made sense, but like everything you're talking about, to make these wind power plants and these solar stuff, it takes coal to produce, to melt the metal to make the big towers for the windmills to be on. It takes coal
to make the steel,
to form the blades for the fans.
No, I understand. It takes enormous amounts of heat to do that. And if we had enough, solar power, if we had enough wind power in this country, then you could have electrically fired furnaces that could do that instead of oil-fired or coal-fired furnaces that would do that. Coal's not the only source of, 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit heat. You could do that
But you said if we had enough. Right now, we've got enough coal to rule the world, but the EPA won't let us mine.
And we've got enough coal to ruin the world. And that's the problem, is it's ruining the world. It was coal. The reason why you can't eat fish out of U.S. waters, every single river and stream and lake in the United States right now, from the Pacific to the Atlantic, every single one is polluted with mercury to the point where if you eat the fish on a regular basis out of our rivers, you are, and particularly if you feed it to your children, you are risking mental illness and mental retardation, damage to the neurological system because of the mercury. And because that mercury is organic mercury, it's many, many times more dangerous than what's called non-organic mercury or mineral mercury, the kind that just get out of the ground. But because it's been run through a biological system, it's got other atoms attached to it to make larger molecules that are biologically active, and they get absorbed by the body and they get into the nervous system and they do incredible damage. That's why the old "mad as a hatter" phrase, it was because those hatters used mercury to form those top hats, and they got it in their hands and it made them crazy, and that's coal is doing that to all of us. So Sammy, I sympathize with your concern about, you know, your part of the country can produce a lot of energy for this country right now, but it's a kind of energy that is harmful to us in the long run. So let's figure out a way that your part of the country can be making, you know, growing hemp and turning it into diesel fuel. That converts sunlight into something that you can put in a truck and power a truck with tomorrow. I mean, there's Kentucky's got some great land. There's a lot that could be done. Why tear it up, pull the coal out, and then when the coal's gone, you're left with nothing. Nothing except a hole. Sammy, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Ludwig, or is it Ludwig, in Orange, Connecticut?
Ludwig, thank you very much for taking my call, Tom. Tom, you know, when that caller before asked about, you know, he's trying to learn about the economy and you weren't sure which book to recommend. You know, when I was in college, I saw Professor Chomsky about 20 times speak. And I would say half of those times, someone would bring up corporate welfare, crony capitalism. And he would literally get angry. And he would say, you know, I don't understand why people in the United States don't understand the economy. It's a very simple thing. And I'm going to tell you what that is, Tom. And I really want your audience to research this and even yourself. We have something called state capitalism, okay? You have three types of economies. You have a command economy, which is like when the government controls it.
Yeah, the old Soviet Union.
Right, then you have a market economy, which is when the market controls it. And then you have mixed economies. And that's what the United States is. It's state capitalism. What is that? That's when the top 1% of the private sector uses the government as a way of controlling the economy. And they don't want markets. They don't want competition. And that's why they send, you know, corporations overseas so that they can go to those industrial revolutions that these third world countries are having. And that way those corporations can control those markets. And that's why you have so much speculation nowadays, because Bretton Woods, you weren't allowed to speculate with currencies and things. And once they got rid of those boundaries and they went on a world fiat currency, they were able to use state capitalism as a model. And if you read Alexander Hamilton, this is the system that he set up. In those days, it wasn't called corporate welfare. They were called bounties. And there's a great book for people to start called Hamilton's Curse by a guy named Thomas DeLorenzo, where he explains how Jefferson wanted to go with Adam Smith and go with what was a market economy, but Hamilton wanted to go with state capitalism, which is what the British Empire was doing. And that's and once you understand that one little fact, Tom, and I know that person that's coming on Monday is going to explain it, and if she understands the economy, she'll explain that in the United States we have state capitalism. You're a big corporation,
Ludwig, respectfully, state capitalism is what China is doing. It's where the state is driving the capitalist system. What we have is crony capitalism or corporate capture of state capitalism, where because of decisions made by the Supreme Court, the corporations in this country have been able to capture the systems, the mechanisms that were put in place to regulate them and capture the legislators who write our tax code, which is another form of regulation for them, so that they can rewrite these things to their own benefit. The consequences are different, and it's really important to realize that. With state capitalism in China, when the state capitalists are sitting around figuring out what they're going to do in their five-year plan, their first question is, how can we use capitalism to advance the interests of China? With the American system, when the corporatists are sitting around, asking themselves, how can we cause the government to pass laws that will benefit us, the corporatists, and screw the American people? What's not in the best interest of the United States government? It's a big difference.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I would also, and to that extent, both of those fall into that mixed economy category, but I would also argue there's no such thing as a pure market economy. Ten minutes before the hour on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, Ted in Palos Hills, Illinois. Hey, Ted, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great.
I overheard, you know, you're talking to Sherrod Brown there, Senator Brown, and, you know, he's looking to put through some legislation to bring back the jobs to us here. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I worry about is, will, you know, these bills get through Congress, get through the Senate? It seems like they're not. You know, yesterday, John McCain flat out said that the assault weapons ban is not going to make it through Congress. Right. He said that in a town hall meeting. And it makes sense because these guys, that are in Congress right now are advocates for the gun industry. So they're not going to vote any other way, you know, regardless of what the public thinks. These are the ones, the gun industry is the reason, you know, these are the people giving them the money so they can keep their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to vote that way. They're not going to vote against them. So it seems like the primary concern should be to get money out, campaign finance reform, filibuster reform, before all these bills even get put forth. Otherwise, you're just going to die. It seems like it's just, you know, we're just spinning our own wheels by putting through these bills. They're not going to make it through, you know, until, you know, people are going to be able to make decisions for the people. And the only reason, the only way they're going to be able to do that is if they know that the guy that's running against them is not going to get money from the gun industry or from coal industry or from the energy industry.
Yeah.
You know?
Ted, here's how I think it's going to play out. Over the next 2 years, you're going to see, first of all, you're going to see our economy kind of limp along and probably, I think we're in a stock bubble right now. It's probably going to burst. We're going to see, you know, we're just going to limp along because our trade policies have not changed. Our fundamentals have not changed. The banksters are still too big to fail. We still have, you know, crony capitalism. You have basically monopolies in every single sector in the American economy. So it's not going to get a whole lot better. It may not get a whole lot worse if the Obama administration can keep their fingers in enough holes in the dike, you know, long enough. But the Republican strategy clearly is to obstruct the Obama administration or Democrats in general from having any successes whatsoever. And then in 2 years, roughly a year and a half from now, a little more than a year and three quarters from now, it's going to be a midterm election. And the midterms are going to be a particularly tough election because in midterms, the Republicans are typically really good at getting their base out. They will put issues on ballots that get their base to turn out, anti-gay issue. Historically, they've been anti-gay, religion in schools, guns, stuff like that, gods, gays, and guns. Now they're going into some other areas, but they'll figure out ways to rig the elections and to get people involved in the elections. Democrats have to be, and progressives in particular, have to be twice as vigilant and effortful. And if we can help the American people realize that over the next year and a half, the Republicans have done everything they can to stop the economy from getting better, to obstruct good legislation, and if the president will continue calling them out like he did earlier this week, using the R word, calling out Republicans by name, or at least by party, if he'll continue doing that, then I think it's possible that the election of 2014 might be a replay of the election of 1948, rather, where Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Congress. He ran against the Republicans in Congress who had been obstructing everything he tried to do in the previous 2 years. And he won. He beat them. And Congress not only flipped Democratic, but flipped Democratic so overwhelmingly that Democrats held that Congress from 1948 all the way to the mid-90s, all the way to the middle of the Clinton administration. So, you know, what is that, almost 50 years, more or less. Maybe more than 50 years. Certainly more than 40 years. And so if we can pull that off, if we can get a Democratic House, and if we can keep a Democratic Senate, then there will be no excuses. And you know, actually, you know, if you look at the first 2.5 months or the first 2 months in 1 week, that Obama was in office when we had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, or at least a Democratic Senate that could withstand a filibuster, we actually got dozens of really, really great pieces of legislation through. I mean, I got a little list here that sometimes it's fun to read. You know, the huge middle-class tax cut, Chrysler was saved, GM saved, education spending increased, student loan costs decreased, hate crime laws strengthened, Affordable Care Act, CHIPS expanded, children health insurance program, enforcement of child labor laws, Wall Street reform, credit card reform, predatory lending to soldiers was ended, troops are now paid for stop loss time. We had torture, the VA spending went up, women can serve on subs, equal pay for women, nuclear arms. I mean, all this stuff, the list goes on and on and on, basically came out of 9 weeks of the Democrats controlling both the House and having enough votes in the Senate to stop a filibuster. And then Senator Brown from Massachusetts was sworn in 2 months into the Obama administration, which gave the Republicans the 40 votes they needed to start, blocking things. And they've been doing it for 5 years now. And if we can help the American people realize that this cabal that met in the caucus room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., the night, January 20th, 2008, the night that President Obama was sworn in, and swore, you know, basically a blood oath to each other. And Paul Ryan was there, this blood oath to each other that they would do everything they can to blow up the president's agenda, to obstruct it. And that if we can, you know, make sure that the American public knows that and we can get that Democratic majority, then I think it's possible that things like Sherrod Brown's legislation not only will pass, but will pass, get signed, get implemented, and you'll see some real significant changes in the last 2 years of the Obama administration. Call me an optimist, but I think that evidence of the first 2 months of the Obama administration, last Obama administration, is proof of this. It's just that most people don't know these things. They don't know the details of these things. Am I making sense, Ted?
Yes, 100%. I'm University of Tom Hartman 3 years now.
Okay. So the job that we have is, because frankly, the Democratic Party and the administration have not been particularly good at messaging on this, is pointing out to all of our friends and everybody we know, every time the Republicans obstruct anything, that the Republicans are trying to block the forward progress of this country. And they're not just trying to block minorities from voting. I mean, they're doing that very effectively and aggressively. And they're not just trying to keep gays in the closet. They're not just trying to restrict, you know, a whole variety of options in life for women, from the workplace to the doctor's office. The Republicans beyond that are trying actively to crash the economy so that they can blame it on Obama. And we just have to point that out to people day after day after day. So, Ted, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for being part of the solution. It is 57 minutes past the hour, and we will be back with Joe Madison. He had a conversation with the president yesterday. I want to hear about it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joe Madison is on the line with us, host of the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time, every single day, weekday of the week, on channel 128. His website is joemadison.com. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Hartman. How are you? And Louise and everybody.
We're fine. I hope you and Sherry are well.
Yeah, I will.
It has been too long since I've seen you.
Well, we're busy. I mean, these are just crazy times.
They are.
People like us, we should be busy. Good gracious. So, but we'll hook up after things slow down.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully.
Yeah.
I understand you had a conversation with the President of the United States yesterday.
Yes, we did. We covered three areas. I actually started out asking my audience, if you had a chance to talk with the President, what questions would you ask him? And we just got an array of questions, but it ended up being boiled down to three areas. One was the oral arguments before the United States Supreme Court regarding the Voting Rights Act, and particularly this is Shelby, I think it's Shelby County versus Holder, regarding Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that deals with preclearance, where certain states, particularly those states that were in heavy violation of people's voting rights, have to have any changes, like gerrymandering, like changing any election laws, pre-cleared by the Justice Department before they can be implemented. And that's being challenged, at least in court now, at least with oral arguments. And we asked him what would be the consequences of that if the Voting Rights Act Section 5 is overturned. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about sequestering and the impact it would have, and I was more concerned about the impact it would have on the poor and working community, particularly, you know, African Americans and Hispanics. And then the third was the importance to future generations of the fact that Rosa Parks' statue will be erected in Statuary Hall actually the 27th. It's going to be a busy day on the 27th. Mm. And she becomes the first African-American woman to have her, to have a, such an honor. And he spoke very candidly about all three issues.
Saying what?
Well, in terms of Voting Rights Act, he quite honestly, he did not seem confident that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act would be upheld. I must be honest with you, and I know that I have talked to some civil rights leaders, those that have organizations, who met with the president immediately after my interview with him, said they got the same feeling. But he basically argued that even if Section 5 is overturned, you still don't lose the major, your voting rights. You still don't lose that. Matter of fact, you can still challenge. But the problem, of course, as he explained, would be you would have to challenge after the election. Well, that can be problematic because let's say, for example, like in Florida, where they got rid of, what was it, Sunday voting, early voting, and there were some other states. Well, you know, the election's over. You either lose or whatever happens, and now you go to court and challenge it. Well, that could take years for to work its way through court. The damage could already be done, particularly in a local election. Let's say for sheriff or for mayor or for whatever, some mm-hmm. local election. And but he, you know, I must tell you, I got the impression that he wasn't that confident that they would have the votes in the Supreme Court, and he sort of took the position that, you know, be prepared.
Wow.
Now, that may be his attitude of being cautious, you know, because nobody knows what the hell the Supreme Court's going to do.
Yeah, maybe it's plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Well,
but Joe,
and I think that's kind of where he came from.
Yeah.
In terms of the sequestering, you know, he said, look, he said all the things that we've heard from people. That, you know, this is going to be very difficult. People are going to be furloughed. It's going to have a rippling effect because, you know, folks who get furloughed, folks who lose their jobs, they spend money. It's going to have an impact on the economy. He also made the point about, and something I haven't heard people talk about, that it's not just about government bureaucrats or government employees or the military. It happens to also be about the money that government spends in buying things.
Mm-hmm.
The government buys a lot of items, and usually it buys it from, not only military contractors, but small businesses, you know, suppliers. I made the point after the interview to some news outlets that, you know, they buy everything from toilet paper to saran wrap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they buy a lot of things, and they have a program in which small businesses can, contract to have their items bought. Well, that's going to dry up. And then someone said, and this is also interesting. Now, this is not what he said, but someone brought out the fact that the Republicans may play a trick, and that is that they'll wring their hands over military budget cuts and how dangerous this is. They'll let it happen, sequestration will happen, and then turn right around a week or so later and introduce a bill that would reinstate the funds that would be cut and force the hand of Democrats to either vote for military spending or vote against it.
Right. Plan on it. Bet on it, Joe.
That's right. And so he said that's what you better watch for. So all this talk about the military and long lines, and then what they'll do is and if you vote against it, if you look soft on defense.
Right. Then they go after you in the next election or you get
primaried. There you go. Now, in terms of Rosa Parks, that's an easy one. He talked about, and being a community organizer came up. and he talked about how she was prepared, and most people forget this, how she was prepared to do what she did.
Mm.
She had worked years with the,
NACP.
She had been a community organizer. She had worked with young people. So she understood the consequences of her actions when she sat down on that bus and basically jump-started the modern civil rights movement. And then he said, of course, you know, for her to be among the giants in politics, in that hall, was, in fact, not only a great honor, but for future generations to recognize that here was a woman that was primarily a seamstress,
mm-hmm.
and made just her actions, her commitment to change, to justice, made a tremendous contribution. And as I said to him, there would not be a Barack Obama for president, or a Joe Madison, or any of us who have benefited from the fact that Rosa Parks sat down so all of us could stand up.
Well said. Joe Madison, joemadison.com. Joe, thanks so much for coming on.
Have a great weekend, and thank you, Tom.
Thanks, you too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Joe Madison's website, joemadison.com. Joe's got a great show and a lot to say. 15 minutes past the hour.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Ah, there you go. It's our pigeon alerts. This is amazing. This is from the Past Imperfect blogs over at the Smithsonian Magazine. This is from the Smithsonian Magazine. The article is The Rise and Fall of Nikola Tesla and His Tower. Now, you all know my theory about pigeons, that the planet Xenu has been spying on us for 10,000 years, according to Scientologists. They seeded the Earth and keeping track of us and looking for the clearers among us so they can take them up to outer space. And so every 6 months they drop a new load of pigeons who are actually robotic spies to figure out what's going on. And that's why whenever you've got, world leaders getting together, very wealthy, powerful people getting together, what do you have? Lots and lots of pigeons. So indeed. And they're clearly robots spying on us and recording everything that we say and do. Louise and I, there's a couple of pigeons that live by our boat. They live on the dock. You walk down the dock, and there's these pigeons following me down the dock. And I'm going, I'm up to you. I know what you're up to. And they sit outside the boat, and obviously they're listening in. And the reason that you know that they're robots is because you never see a dead pigeon. You never see a baby pigeon, right? What could it be? It's a robot. Okay. So Nikola Tesla. The article, I'm going to read to you the first paragraph of the article and the next to the last paragraph of the article. The article runs 5 pages long, but here's the first paragraph of the article. By the end of his brilliant and tortured life, the Serbian physicist, engineer, and inventor Nikola Tesla was penniless and living in a small New York City hotel room. He spent days in a park surrounded by the creatures that mattered most to him, pigeons. That's how it opens. Here's how it ends, this article from the Smithsonian. Near the end of his life, Tesla became fixated on pigeons. One night, Tesla claimed a white pigeon visited him through an open window at his hotel, and he believed the bird had come to tell him that she was dying. He saw, quote, two powerful beams of light, end quote, in the bird's eyes. He later said, quote, yes, it was a real light, a powerful, dazzling, blinding light, a light more intense than I had ever produced by the most powerful lamps in my laboratory, end of quote. Pigeon died in his arms, and the inventor claimed that at that moment he knew that he had finished his life's work. By the way, the New York Times reports that Tesla at that time was working on a death beam capable of knocking 10,000 enemy airplanes out of the skies. Now, you tell me, Tesla wasn't, you know, his whole life he spent hanging out with pigeons, and this is the world's greatest inventor? Okay, item one. Item two. Next week, the Supreme Court is going to debate whether the Voting Rights Act is constitutional. Now, the Voting Rights Act is an attempt by the federal government, Congress, to pass a law to make sure that people of color have the ability to vote. And the Supreme Court, the buzz is that the Supreme Court's going to find this unconstitutional. So let me just, I'm going to throw this out to you for the common sense test. Just plain old common sense test. The voting, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which has to do with the right of African Americans to vote, freed slaves at the time that this was passed. This was ratified on February 3rd, 1870. The 15th Amendment is two sentences long. This is not rocket science, and it shouldn't require a constitutional scholar to figure out whether Congress has the power to create legislation to make sure that black people are not discriminated against. That's the case before the Supreme Court. It's going to be argued that, no, Congress overreached. Congress did not have the power to make sure that black people can vote, or people of any race, directly as a consequence of their vote, that their right to vote has not been infringed. So let me read to you, listen carefully, the entirety of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. That's section one, one sentence. Section two, the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Period. Full stop. So, number one, can't discriminate based on race. Number two, Congress can pass laws to make sure that doesn't happen. And the Supreme Court is going to blow this up. How? This is going to be a real interesting one to keep. And especially after Joe Madison says, you know, he talked to the President of the United States yesterday, and the President said, get ready. That says to me that we have a Supreme Court that is not interested in being the Supreme Court. We have a Supreme Court that's interested in being the kings of America. That we have devolved to a constitutional monarchy, where the monarchs are the nine men and women who sit on the Supreme Court, because they have the power to dissolve laws. In the United Kingdom, the Queen has the power to dissolve Parliament. She is sovereign above all. Here in the United States, the Supreme Court fills that role. It was not the role envisioned by Congress. Not at all. Okay. I also promised that I would share with you my theory on Mercury going retrograde. I learned, and actually I'll do that a little later. I'll do that in the third hour. Let me get back to that. But the Supreme Court is claiming that they have the power to dissolve these laws, and yet Article 3, Section 2, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Does that not make the Congress superior to the Supreme Court? And yet the Supreme Court is going to strike down a law passed by Congress? What's wrong with this picture? I think this is totally bizarre. This is a classic example of, you know, I mean, the conservatives scream about, you know, judicial overreach and judicial activism, their specific examples are Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. You can't have segregated schools, and Roe v. Wade in 1973. A woman has the right to have an abortion within limits. And you could argue that in both cases the court was making law. I would actually buy that argument. But for conservatives to yell and scream about Brown v. Board and Roe v. Wade and then say, oh, yeah, and by the way, please knock down the Voting Rights Act, I think there's something really wrong with that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's either judicial activism or it's not. It's either constitutional or it's not. And frankly, we need to do something about it. Franklin Roosevelt was the last president to seriously try. I got to do that. We got some old blinds on our boat. I mean, like 30 years old. It's time to... We actually, long before Blinds.com was an advertiser to our program, or an underwriter, or whatever you want to call it, we used them to replace all the blinds in our floating home in Portland. This was like 6 years ago, and it was just a great experience. They did good work. Okay, Nikolai Tesla, pigeons, Mercury retrograde. Somebody in the chat room the other day asked me Actually, I said I was going to talk about this in the third hour. I'll hold it off. It's Anything Goes Friday. We should be taking your calls. My apologies. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota, listening on AM 950, Minnesota's progressive voice. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Anything Goes Fridays are your form of our brain stimulation and supplement, and I appreciate that. But the reason for my call is I'm a guy who's been around for over a half century, and I believe I've witnessed the global warming, the effects of it in my lifetime. And what I'm concerned with is how it seems that we've allowed the conversation to change from global warming to climate change, the way that it's being referenced. And if you look at the brief history of it, for so long, people denied that there was global warming. And then when the preponderance of evidence showed that there was global warming, now they're saying, well, it's just climate change. And we've been through climate changes before.
Right.
And my response to that, in fact, they love to say, we've been through periods of warming of the globe before, but I guess my point is we've never been through periods of warming when we had over 6 billion people on Earth and 30,000 airplane flights a day and 800 million automobiles and coal-fired power plants and all this myriad of things that add more carbon to the air.
Well, and the times that we have had really significant, like 5 degrees Celsius warmings before, they've been called extinctions.
Well, I just wish we wouldn't allow them to make that change, to go from global warming to kind of dumbing it down to climate.
Yeah, somebody called the program a week or so ago and said, you know, where did this climate change come from? Why aren't we calling it global warming? And I said at the time that I thought that it came out of the scientific community, that they wanted to be a little more precise. And several listeners pointed me to links, and you can read the threads over on our blogs at tomhartman.com. Pointed me to links that showed that this was actually a suggestion of Frank Luntz's.
Well, I believe that completely. In fact, I think that's probably why the scientific community is making that change, is they're just trying to soften it enough so they believe they'll be listened to a little bit more. But I think we need to be real, real serious about it and use the words global warming.
I think we need to use the words global disaster, and we need to talk about extinctions. And I'm serious talking about extinctions. The last major extinction on Earth, not the last one, but the second to the last. The last one was the end of the Jurassic period, and that was when 65 million years ago a meteorite hit the Earth in near where what is now Cancun, left a giant crater, which is that basin there off the coast of Mexico that leads into the Gulf of Mexico, and that crater. Excuse me, that meteor killed roughly 60% of all life on Earth, including virtually all of the dinosaurs, with the exception of some of the holdovers like the alligators and things, and some of the smaller ones, and apparently birds, which came out of dinosaurs. But the extinction that preceded it was, it's called the Permian extinction, and it happened 250 million years ago. And up until the 1990s, nobody knew what caused it. The assumption was always that it had been a meteor strike like the other extinctions were, either meteor strikes or massive tectonic activity, you know, changing of continents, breaking up of continents and things, blowing all kinds of lava out into the atmosphere. And nobody really got what caused the Permian extinction. And there's a brilliant documentary over on BBC about this, that the Permian extinction was caused, first off, it had two, there were two killers. The Permian extinction, first of all, is important because 95% of all species, 95% of all life on Earth vanished. It was a period of at least 80,000 years of the planet being virtually sterile and tens of millions of years that it took for the planet to come back. And then, you know, 65 million years of, for the dinosaurs to fully evolve before the next strike happened. And so what caused the Permian extinction? It's been this big question. Well, it turns out that there was this area that are known as the Siberian Traps, this northern Siberia, hundreds of square miles that just kind of opened up as a giant volcano or not volcanic activity. It was called sheet lava, just these giant flows of lava out onto the ground. And in the process released so much gaseous material, so much particulate material, and in particular so much carbon dioxide that it warmed the planet 5 degrees Celsius. Now, there's been a strong consensus that that's what happened ever since the early 90s, you know, when they first really found the evidence of this up in Siberia. But the question has been, 5 degrees Celsius is enough to kill off 60% of the life on Earth, but not 95%. It's not enough to basically sterilize the planet. And just to put this in context, by the way, the scientists with the IPCC are suggesting that if we keep on the course that we're on, and nobody thinks we will, we're not that insane, but if we continue to pollute at the level we are, by the year 2100, we will have raised the temperature of the Earth 5 to 6 degrees Celsius. So just keep that in mind as I'm telling you this story. So the Siberian traps blew out all this lava, and that lava and the gases from it, the carbon dioxide in particular, raised the temperature of the Earth by 5 degrees Celsius. But like I said, that's not enough to kill everything. So what was it that killed everything? Well, it turned out that along the coasts of all, you know, on all of our oceans, along that area where the land becomes sea, where the land subducts under the water, where the land goes down under the water, or the water covers the land, you've got the areas of greatest biodiversity on the planet. And because of their edges, you know, edges are always places of great diversity and activity. And you've got a lot of life, particularly vegetable life, you know, algae, giant mats of algae, all kinds of green stuff and little tiny plankton and all kind, and animal life as well, the zoo, whatever it's called, the zooplankton. And this stuff has a life cycle, and part of that life cycle is it dies. And when it dies, it settles to the bottom. As it settles to the bottom, it's rotting. And as it's rotting, it's producing methane gas. You know, it's the stuff that you smell when you smell rotting vegetation. It's how cows fart. It's how all of us fart, actually. It's methane. And methane is also known as natural gas. So anyhow, these things are rotting, and they're sinking to the bottom. And as they sink to the bottom and they rot, the methane that is released at high pressures, hundreds of feet under the ocean, get locked up in these crystalline lattices of water that is at or just slightly below the freezing temperature, but doesn't freeze because the pressure is so high. But when it combines with the methane, it actually forms these like little boxes around the methane crystals, and it forms these giant sheets of a slurry kind of ice that are called methane hydrate crystals. And hundreds of trillions of tons of them along the coasts of all the continents. And they're there, and they're frozen because they're in an area that's maybe only 60, 70 feet of depth, where above that, the methane would turn into a gas and bubble up to the surface. And below that, the vegetable material doesn't, you know, no longer decomposes and produces methane. So it's a very specific layer that you find all around the world. And there's all this methane hydrate, and the oil companies have been exploring how to suck this stuff up because it's almost pure natural gas mixed with water, and it's easy to separate water from natural gas. And there's been a couple of attempts to do so. And so anyhow, one of the things that they learned when they were in the late 90s, when they were drilling for methane hydrate crystals off the coast of England, one of the things that they learned was that this stuff was really, really rich in what's called carbon-12, a form of carbon that is an absolute signature of rapidly decomposing plant matter. About the same time, a group of geologists who were looking at the Permian extinction in Antarctica, in South Africa, and in Greenland found that in the Permian extinction layers, that 80,000-year layer, about 40,000 years into it, long after the Siberian traps had stopped erupting, but while the planet was still 5 degrees warmer, because it takes a long time for that CO2 to go out of the atmosphere, about 40,000 years into this, there was a second giant warming of the planet. And that second giant warming of the planet warmed the planet by an additional 5 degrees, which sterilized the planet, which killed 95% of all life, because we were now at 10 degrees Celsius of warming, and that is enough to kill 95% of all life. And at the very time that that happened, they expected to see the signature of a meteorite hitting, you know, a large amount of iridium all around the planet. Instead, what they found was carbon-12. So the question was, how the hell did carbon-12, which is the product of centuries of plant decomposition, end up in the atmosphere in such massive amounts that it's buried 40,000 years into the layer of the Permian mass extinction? Turns out that 5 degrees Celsius temperature increase in the planet was enough over that 40,000 years to warm the oceans to the point where that layer of methane hydrate crystals warmed up and all those crystals started melting, releasing the gas. Gas bubbled up into the air. Methane is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide and it's a greenhouse gas. And so for the next 40,000 years, it raised the temperature 10 degrees Celsius, and that was the Permian extinction. And that is what we are doing to ourselves with all of this talk about clean coal and all this nonsense about, you know, gas, natural gas being a clean energy source and all that. Todd, sorry to go off on you, but and that we ran out of time for you to respond. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Apropos of and back to what Todd said, instead of calling it climate change and global warming, we need to start talking about the next Permian extinction. We need to talk about climate crisis. Welcome back. You can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And Victoria Jones for the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and also the effort to free Don Siegelman, free-don.com. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria, what's going on?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, well, nice to see your smiley face.
Yes, thank you. Well, I was sitting in the briefing room in the White House waiting for Jay Carney to come out and drone, and not that kind of drone.
Oh, you mean drone on?
Yes, not that kind of drone.
Duck, Victoria, duck!
Yes, oh no! Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood came out, and everybody suddenly brightened up and woke up and perked up because he's colorful.
Colorful meaning... He swears a lot? I mean, usually that's what people mean when they say colorful.
He talks straight.
He talks
no nonsense.
Isn't Ray LaHood a Republican, by the way?
Yes, he is.
Interesting. So he's got basically nothing to lose. He's been like Chuck Hagel. You know, he's a Republican who's part of a Democratic administration.
Right.
So the Republicans hate him, and the Democrats are never going to trust him because he's not a Democrat. So what the hell? Let's just be honest.
And he's on his way out. He was asked a question about whether it was a scare tactic. He said, the idea we're just doing this to create some sort of horrific scare tactic is just nonsense.
You're talking about the sequester?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he said, staring at the person who asked the question.
Hmm.
I mean, he just doesn't mess about. Basically, he came out to warn America and to scare America a little bit about what's going to happen with transportation, particularly air transportation, if the automatic cuts known as the sequester come into effect. And he said, you're not going to feel them straight away, probably April, middle of April, early May, but maybe even early April. You're going to see... because of cuts, you're going to see the FAA forced to close dozens of control towers and eliminate overnight shifts at others, in turn prompting airlines to cancel or delay flights. Delays are going to be as much as 90 minutes at major airports.
That will get people's attention, particularly people who can make decisions.
Yes, and he said it's going to get the voters' attention, and they're going to start calling their members of Congress. He said they used to call me when they were delayed. He said my phones used to ring when people couldn't get on planes. He said the members of Congress are going to get them.
Well, members of Congress themselves use planes a lot, too.
Exactly. Yeah. The cuts would also slow airport maintenance because of the thousands of furlough days that would hit the transportation department's workforce of 55,000. So, of course, air traffic controllers are going to be furloughed to save money. So he was laying it all out. He talked about New York, Chicago, San Francisco, other major cities being impacted. But he also talked about smaller cities being impacted and losing their control towers completely.
Wow.
And other cities, of course, losing their midnight shifts. In fact, in his own hometown of Peoria would be losing his overnight shift of a control tower. So if you don't have a control tower, anybody flying over can't fly over.
Right. Well, they can't land anyway.
Right. They can't land.
Yeah.
So, you know, he said that the transportation is looking at everything it can do to soften the blows, including looking at every contract. He said, but the agency's hands are tied because the sequester doesn't allow for moving money around. And I think that's one of the things that is really important for people to understand. The way this bill was written, it ties the money up so much that it literally is across the board. You have to cut the money from the janitor's cat as much as you cut the money from the air traffic controller.
And of course, let us not forget that John Boehner, when he negotiated the sequester, had this to say.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
Is he still happy?
I suspect not.
We'll see how this plays out. It's going to be interesting.
That's not.
Oh, by the way, Joe Madison, you know, talked to the president yesterday, and he shared with me, he said this wasn't something the president said, it was something one of his listeners said, but Joe, I don't want to characterize what he had to say. Let me just ask you about it. Could it be possible that the Republicans have prepared legislation that would undo the defense part of the sequester, period, ignore the social, you know, government side of the sequester, and that March 2nd, they will introduce that to the House, pass it, send it to the Senate, and say, dare ya.
Yes, it's quite possible. The legislation that they passed twice in the House last Congress was very similar to that. That's the legislation that went nowhere in the Senate. What it basically did, and this is the legislation that the Republicans are touting now when they say, we've already passed legislation that would get rid of the sequester.
Right.
What it did was it basically eliminated the cuts to defense and put all the cuts on domestic programs, making them far more draconian, which is one of the reasons why it went nowhere in the Senate.
Right. So if the sequester is in effect and legislation to that effect goes to the Senate, are the Democratic senators going to be afraid to vote against it for fear that they'll be attacked for not supporting the military?
No, I don't think so. I think that they will point out what these cuts do to domestic programs.
So they will say we're not going to pass this until you give us the whole enchilada.
Yes, I think they will, and maybe they'll introduce a similar bill. I mean, they've already come up with their own program that balance is the word they use. It's a mixture of tax increases and cuts. And the point that they're going to make is that it has to be balanced. And the poll that came out yesterday, USA Today and Pew, shows that 76% of the public wants a mixture and only 19% of the public wants all cuts.
Right. Right. And that's lower than the percentage of the public that believes in flying saucers. Or that Elvis is still alive.
Which is astonishing when you think about that.
Yeah. There you go. So half a minute. What else is going on?
President Obama, in one of his interviews with African-American hosts yesterday, tried to calm people about the case up before the Supreme Court next week about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, telling people that they won't lose the right to vote if the Supreme Court strikes down the key provision of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. That host being Joe Madison. Yeah.
Yes. And we'll talk more about that case, of course, next week.
Yeah. Okay. Great. And in fact, I'm certain we will. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.com. Check them out. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the third hour of Anything Goes Friday, and I'm going to share my Anything Goes with you, and then we'll open the mics for yours. Speaking of, and of course I think we've pretty much covered a lot of the news that's going on today. Immigration reform, you know, it turns out that the major opponent of immigration reform is the private prison industry, which is making so much money. They're giving a lot of it to Marco Rubio. And it's amazing. The sequester is rolling along. Voters in Italy are going to have a chance to say no to austerity. That's the good news. The bad news, who's the anti-austerity candidate? Silvio Berlusconi! Indeed. So maybe pretty soon we'll be able to do Berlusconi alerts again. You know, Shano and I were talking about this during the break, and Jim and Danielle and I. If I lived in Italy and Berlusconi was running and his camp and his, you know, his opponent is saying more austerity and Berlusconi is saying, screw the EU, we're going to pull out, we're going to go back to the lira, we're going to stop the austerity nonsense, I'd vote for Berlusconi. I don't care what, you know, so he's doing bunga bunga parties. I mean, it's, yeah, it's kind of offensive, but, and so he's a oligarch who owns all the media in the country. Well, that's even more offensive, frankly, than the bunga bunga parties, but still. I think from the point of view of the average Italian. But anyhow, I wanted to talk to you about Mercury going retrograde in astrology for a moment. These are the two things that I know about astrology. And this is all I know about it. I know that when I was 17 years old, I was dating a young woman. Her name was Sheila. I was dating Sheila, and she made the comment. This was during the 2 years or so between the time I first met Louise and we dated and the second time I met her and we moved in together the next day and got married, and that's the end of that. But during this period of time, not the end of that, that's the rest of this. Now you know the rest of the story, right? That was 40 years ago. During that period of time, I was dating Sheila, and Sheila was really into astrology. And she made me a bet, which involved a number of things that I probably shouldn't talk about on the radio, that I really wanted to win. And this bet was that statistically, there's 12 astrological signs, right? Three each of the four types of astrological signs, air, fire, water, and earth. And the earth signs are what? Capricorn, Virgo, and Taurus. And the water signs are Pisces and Scorpio and Cancer. And, no, Aquarius is an air sign, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. And Leo is a fire sign. I don't remember the air and fire signs all that well. But in any case, that's how much I don't know about astrology. But my bet with Sheila was, she said, you know, half the population belongs to six signs. It doesn't even matter if you organize them into the four categories. You know, there's 12 signs. Half the population is half the signs, right? So half your friends should represent half the signs. Now, I'm a Taurus. Sheila was a Capricorn. We were both earth signs. And she was like, her theory was that earth signs and water signs were real compatible, and they ended up being good long-term friends and really tight. And there were, the exception to this was if your birth sign or your moon sign was one of these. But in any case, so I guess there was an out. But she said basically that she bet me that more than half of my friends, actually her bet was more than 70% of my friends would fall into six signs, which is 50% of the signs. And being a total science geek, I said, you're on. You know, that's crazy. That's not possible. And so I literally made a list. Sheila and I sat down and I made a list of all the, you know, and I came up with a list, not knowing what their signs were, of the people that I considered my 20 or 30 closest friends. And then I called them or visited them and asked them what their birth sign was, and I filled it in on the list. And sure enough, it wasn't 70%. It was more like 80%. Me being an earth sign, Taurus. She said, you're going to be compatible. What you're going to find is that virtually, not virtually all, because there are exceptions. I have very, very close friends who are water signs and air signs. But she said that most of your really close friends, the people you instantly feel comfortable and familiar with, are water and earth signs, because you're an earth sign. And she said, probably there won't be a lot of Tauruses, because you see too much of yourself in them. So this is her theory. So I went around and asked. And actually, it was something like 75-80%. I forget the percentage, but it was most of my friends were Pisces, Cancer, Scorpio, Virgo, and Capricorn. Five signs, actually. I had a couple friends who were Tauruses, but mostly not so much. And then the other six signs, the water and air signs, there were a couple, but not so many. And I couldn't, you know, it's like to this day, I'm mystified by that. So that's the first thing I know about astrology. The second thing I know is that back 20 years ago, I had a publisher who refused to return my phone calls when Mercury was retrograde. Wouldn't sign a contract when Mercury was retrograde. Actually, he would return my phone calls. He wouldn't answer the phone when Mercury was retrograde. Doesn't to this day. a real publisher, published several of my books. And I was like, what's the deal? And Tim was like, when Mercury is retrograde, anything that you start is going to fail. Mercury retrograde is the equivalent of the winter for hibernating animals. It's the time when you go inward. It's the time when you do the inner work. It's the time when you think and plan and gather information. And then when Mercury is not retrograde, and by retrograde it means that the planet appears to be moving away from the Earth. It's not actually, but it appears to be moving away from the Earth. And when it's not retrograde, when it's moving with or toward the Earth, then that's the rest of the time. It happens about four times a year for about 3 weeks each. And the rest of the time when Mercury is not retrograde, get out there and kick butt. So I just started noticing, because the official astrology story is that when Mercury is retrograde, communication goes to hell. People misunderstand each other, make airline reservations. You discover later that they put you in the wrong month. You start a business, it's going to fail. Anything you do that, you know, when, if you do it, if you pull the switch when Mercury's retrograde, it ain't going to work. And so for the last, I don't know, 8, 10 years, 20 years, 15 years, some long time, actually, it's been since before we started this radio show. I have not signed contracts in Mercury's retrograde. In fact, I almost blew up a very substantial book advance, arguably one of the largest I've ever gotten, which is not enough to, you know, be independently wealthy and retire on, but still it was a lot of money, because I would not sign the contract until 2.5 weeks later when Mercury wasn't retrograde anymore. It's like my publisher was convinced I was crazy. I think at that point they were like, do we really want to? And then the thing that saved me was that somebody in the publishing house came to my defense and said, well, I wouldn't buy a house when Mercury's retrograde. So anyhow, how could this be? Now, the theory I've been operating on my whole entire life is that there's probably something to astrology that I just haven't figured out. But it hit me last week. Somebody in the chat room brought this up. You know, what's the deal? And it hit me, of course, it's got nothing to do with astrology. What it has to do with is the fact that at some deep level, we are all connected. Our minds are all connected. Whether you want to use the Heisenberg kind of Einstein, you know, we're all connected in a cosmic way, super string, whatever. Whether you want to use the Edgar Cayce, we're all connected psychically. Or if you want to just use Marshall McLuhan, you know, we're all connected by the common culture and the zeitgeist of the time. We're all connected. And so if we share a belief, if enough of us share a belief, that belief becomes self-fulfilling. And I'm increasingly thinking, particularly as more and more people get more and more concerned about Mercury getting retrograde, and it seems like our Mercury retrograde periods are getting worse and worse, I'm increasingly thinking that what we are seeing here is the group mind. Not anything that has to do with whether or not, you know, Venus is in Sagittarius. But I could be wrong. Who knows?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So that's my Anything Goes for Anything Goes Friday. We'll pick up yours after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's Anything Goes Friday. Michael just called and said that he thought that the dragon of King Arthur's court was actually a tornado. Hey, it's flying. It's in the air. You run in the other direction. It's got lightning. That makes perfect sense. Could be. That kind of falls in the category of, I'll share my last two final weird theories with you. I've shared these before. I don't think I shared the other stuff before, but... why, when Louise and I were invited, when I was invited and Louise was, came along with me, and turned out she ended up being invited too, to meet Pope John Paul II. And for a private audience. And when we got there to the Vatican, the Pope's assistant showed us around, spent part of the day with us, showed us through the Vatican, gave us the kind of VIP tour, see the places the tourists don't see, that kind of stuff. And then we went up to up to Castel Gandolfo, where we actually spent 3 hours with the Pope watching a concert, and then afterwards had a private audience with him. And the picture of my shaking his hand is up on our website. The picture of Louise shaking his hand is at home. Initially she was told that he wouldn't shake her hand, but he did. But in any case, the question, he said, do you have any questions for me? Not the Pope, but his assistant. And I said, yeah, why does the Pope wear a yarmulke? Why does he wear a kippah? And he was like, you know, I've been a priest since I was in my 20s, and I have no idea. And this was a guy in his 60s. He says, I have no idea. He says, but I'll find out. And about 3-4 months later, he sent me this long letter saying that he had researched it, and he couldn't come up with an answer. All he could find was that around the year 800, as I recall, the Pope and also Jews started wearing yarmulkes about the same time, within a generation of each other. So my theory is that either a Jewish leader or a pope, and then the other group followed, had male pattern baldness and was self-conscious about it. And so came up with this thing about got to cover the back of your head because the kippah is the yarmulke goes exactly where male pattern baldness would be. And that's what brought that about. My other theory about, you know, having lived in Europe for a year, I've noticed that all over Europe, all these different languages from Serbian and Croatian to German and Spanish and Portuguese and I've heard them all, you know, Norwegian, Danish, Dutch, all of them sound like a normal language except French. In French, they all talk out of their nose, you know, they're talking like they've got a speech impediment. And they don't even pronounce things, you know. Instead of saying Montpellier, they say Montpellier. Well, where's the R? It went away. We don't know. So here's my theory about why the French speak French. I'll bet that 500, 600, 700, 800 years ago, there was a French king who had a really severe speech impediment and couldn't pronounce certain sounds. Couldn't pronounce the R's at the end of words. You know, kind of slurred and mumbled his words. Maybe he had a cleft palate. I don't know if the cleft palate does it or if there's some sort of deformity inside his mouth or what it was. And so he spoke with a funny accent, you know, and he talked like that. And so everybody, when they went into the court to speak with him, they would talk like that so that they sounded like him so he didn't feel self-conscious, you understand. And that's why French sounds like a Romance language being spoken with a speech impediment, because nobody wanted to get their head cut off by the king, or everybody wanted to be in the king's good graces, and so then it became very popular, and then the commoners started imitating it, and pretty soon, it's a language! So, I have no proof for either of those theories. None whatsoever. But I like them. Noah, in Longmont, Colorado, listening to AM 760. Hey, Noah, what's on your mind today?
How's it going, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Make a point, brought up a lot of these issues about all the economic problems, about climate change, global warming.
Mm.
I think the best step to take to solve all these problems really is campaign finance reform. You talk a lot about Citizens United. I think the best thing we can do about Citizens United is, let's say, pass a constitutional amendment that would say only things, because corporations are now people, only things that can vote can contribute to campaigns.
Right. Why not simply say only humans have rights under the Constitution? And by the way, money is not speech. It is money. And then you can have campaign finance reform. But right now it's illegal. It's unconstitutional to have campaign finance reform because you might cut out, you know, the ability of money to be speech, First Amendment, and you might cut out the right of corporations to be people.
I mean, yeah, that's totally true. I would say that I think passing a constitutional amendment would kind of, I guess, supersedes Citizens United.
Mm-hmm. It would immediately cause it to be struck down. It would neutralize it. And we've done this before. I mean, you know, when we passed the law to make alcohol illegal, prohibition, and then when we repealed prohibition. I mean, what it did is it blew up all the existing laws on the books, and changed them. So it's not a big deal. I mean, it is a big deal to pass a constitutional amendment, but it can be done quickly. The constitutional amendment, I think, is the 26th, 27th, the one to allow 18-year-olds to vote. That thing was, in fact, let me get the exact dates. I keep talking about this, and I should look it up so actually, you know, share it with you. Amendments to the Constitution. Where did it go? Okay. Suffrage in the District of Columbia, poll taxes, disability, suffrage for 18-year-olds. Okay, it is the 26th Amendment to the Constitution. It was proposed on March 23rd, 1971, and ratified on July 1st, 1971. March, June, July. So this thing took less than 3 months, right? It took two months and a week to go from dropping it in Congress to three quarters of the states, to both houses of Congress passing it and three quarters of the states having their state legislatures pass it. It took 2 months and 3 weeks. And
I mean,
that's incredible. Or two months and 1 week, actually.
That, I mean, that is incredible. I would might attribute that to the fact that I guess voting rights for 18-year-olds wouldn't be as, let's say, controversial or influential as saying getting money out of politics.
But see, I think, you know, the just as many people right now agree that money should not be in politics as agreed that 18-year-olds should be able to vote. By the way, the 27th Amendment, the Congressional Salaries, that was ratified in May 7th, 1992, guess what year that was first introduced?
I don't know.
Just take a wild-ass guess.
1975.
1789.
Wow.
Yeah. It was proposed on September 25th, 1789, during the George Washington administration. 89, that would be right? Yeah. And ratified on May 7th, 1992. Incredible. Noah, thanks a lot for the... So it can be tough. Thanks, Noah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But there is hope. There is hope. And we can get money out of politics, and it's going to require a constitutional amendment. So go to movetoamend.org and join up. Have you ever looked at side-by-side pictures of Ted Cruz and Joe McCarthy? I'm not making this up. It's like we're talking about astrology. This is reincarnation. I mean, these guys look so much alike. It is spooky. It is absolutely spooky. So, oh, Nancy knows the reason why popes wear yarmulkes. Hey, Nancy. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air. Nancy?
Hello?
Hey.
Yes?
Hi, you're on. Why do popes wear yarmulkes?
The popes wear yarmulkes and the Jewish men wear yarmulkes because it's a respect for God. It's to remind you to cover your head.
It's no, I get that, but why didn't they respect God before 800 AD?
Pardon me?
Why didn't they respect God before 800 AD? That's when they started, both of them.
I think the Jewish people probably did. Maybe the popes do it as a spinoff. I think maybe the Jewish people always wore a covering on their head. Mm. And it got interesting because in congregations in the Catholic Church, it got so the priest never wore anything on his head, but the women couldn't come to church unless they had a hat on or had their head covered.
Right. Well, St. John... Whoever it is, it was Paul who wrote all those various letters. I think it was in one of the letters to the Corinthians. He said, women should cover their heads and remain silent when they're in church.
I guess it's to cover your hair, other than getting it all cut off, so
yeah.
Men don't look at you and watch
but
you pretty hairdo or whatever. But the whole thing of covering your head is whenever it started, whoever did it, is actually out of respect for God and as a reminder that you're just a man, and that there's a space between a man's behavior and who Almighty God overall is.
That doesn't make any sense to me, though. I mean, if you respect God, and particularly, I mean, the Bronze Age sky gods, who were basically the gods of the Old Testament, were supposed to be up in the sky, up in the air. And if you're covering your head, you're separating yourself from them. If you're respecting that God, shouldn't you leave your head bare so that you can be in better contact with him? I know Paul told women to cover their heads.
So that you can think in your brain, huh?
Yeah, I mean, Paul told women to cover their heads, but not men. And maybe that was because...
Through your heart, or maybe it's more of a spiritual. I'm just telling you why. I don't know their reason.
Okay, you're telling me the story that you were told about why.
I'm not Jewish, but I joined a Jewish congregation for a while.
Yeah. Okay.
And I know that's why the yarmulke was worn. And the Catholic Church is a spinoff from Jewish congregations.
Well, yeah, Jesus was a Jew, of course. But Jesus didn't wear a yarmulke either, so it's all...
No, he didn't. And if he looks like the pictures they have of him, they always have him pictured with pretty hair, I guess. But then that's been an Orthodox. The yarmulkes and the whatever have been a more Orthodox belief. And as we've come in Reformation and Protestantism and whatever, they never played those kinds of games.
Yeah, we kind of did away with it. Well,
I want to remind you, too. I don't want to take up your time. I know you're busy. But I also want to remind you that back in those days of the priests, And the Jewish, they were the only ones also who could read the Bible,
mm-hmm.
who had copies of the Bible.
Well,
so they kept a kind of an elite.
Yeah, in particular Catholicism, and this is,
right. There was a distance between God and them, and then there was a distance between them and their people.
You're right. Nancy, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. In fact, a friend of mine who lives in Beit Shearim in Jerusalem pointed out to me, and he had arguably an axe to grind about this, but he was like, okay, what if in a society you said the smartest people can learn to read and write, but they're not allowed to reproduce, and the dumbest people are not allowed to read and write, but they can have all the babies they want? Over hundreds and hundreds or thousands of years, what's going to be the result? And I'm like, oh, I know where this is going. And at least I thought I knew where I was going. And he was like, well, that was, you know, what the church did for a lot of years. They said you can't read and write unless you become celibate. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. No. But then you meet Catholics who are just, you know, the Jesuits, you know, brilliant scholars. Can't be. But I do think that for most things that we look at and we say, you know, this is really weird, you know, whether it's wearing the yarmulke or speaking French, or why are pigs not kosher? There were practical reasons. Trichinomiasis for pigs, you know, shellfish, they're bottom feeders. They're more likely to have contaminants. Max in Glendale, Arizona. Hey, Max, energy alternatives?
Indeed, and hello, Tom.
Hey.
I've had a nagging idea that I think might have some, well, might be pretty viable,
mm-hmm.
to combine two things. One, the future of our energy options, and secondly, the necessity to revitalize our highway system. I guess I would quickly frame it with the historical truth of this country in that our interstate and our U.S. highway system has only matured to its full potential. When it was originally built, it was built for very different motivations, but it's become an invaluable means of convenience and commerce.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar vein, what if we were to combine a network of wiring and substations only across, connected with our interstate and U.S. highway traveling lanes as part of their refurbishment? And then next step, allow individual municipalities, either large or small, to tap into that at their own discretion.
I would prefer to see individual municipalities generating electricity locally. I think we need to have a lot more emphasis on local electricity. Line losses are huge. You know, 17% of all the electricity manufactured in the United States is lost in transmission line losses. On the other hand, if we were to, every time we build resurface or whatever, an interstate highway, if we were to lay a good fiber optic cable underneath it, you know, so that communities would have access to high-quality broadband. I mean, literally every house in South Korea has a T1 line coming into it. You know,
I heard that recently from you. And yeah. I guess the only thing I would piggyback, even with the line loss, the discussions of alternative energy, when spoken about honestly, this country has the future potential to really have well beyond the abundance of energy, no matter what our needs become, if we were to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in connection with kind of how Alaska does their thing, if a municipality wanted to join, have a requirement that 30% of the revenue, because it's hard to fight capitalism in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So people are going to want to sell it. They're not going to want to give it away. But plus, it has to be financed. But if the municipality taps in, have it stipulated that 30% of the revenue goes to the municipality, 70% goes equally to all of the citizens of that municipality, which gives the common folk a stake in the investment, the municipality a stake in the investment, and a reason to transfer that power to other less forward-thinking areas. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Here's why I think it's a bad idea. No offense. I don't think that here's what the experience of the former Soviet states were in Russia was. They took publicly owned things, and this was done at the insistence of the Chicago economics boys, you know, who went over there, the sub-geniuses to help them out. They took publicly owned things, and they said, okay, here's a power station. It's worth, $1 million, so we'll create 1 million shares worth $1 a piece, and we'll give those to all the people in the community who own that. Or, you know, probably a better example is housing stock. You know, here's an apartment building. It's worth X. And so we're going to give everybody a coupon that's equal to value. People can trade these coupons. And so then people started going around. The oligarchs started going around buying up coupons. People would get in a bind and they'd sell off some of their coupons. They'd sell off part of the energy. And what has happened is that you've now got, you know, a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred or a couple thousand oligarchs who own most of Russia, who own most of the individual former Soviet states. And everybody else is out in the cold, screwed. And that, I mean, that's a horrible oversimplification, but it's what has happened in the United States as well when we privatized public utilities and tried to give everybody a stake in them. Here's your piece of that utility. I think that a utility should be fully owned by the government, and your ownership in it is controlled by your vote. Make sense?
I can see that, and I can see the hazard you're speaking to. In the near future, when we need to address this, we need to get started now, not later. I'm trying to wrap my head around how the most impoverished areas of our country, some places in the South, Detroit would be an example, California is in a financial mess, how they can make real these enormous investments toward future energy when they really have empty pockets right now. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but the reality is that they shouldn't have empty pockets. There is so much wealth in this country. We are the richest country on earth. And if we can't take some of that wealth and invest it in the future in ways that will produce returns way over 100%. Now, you put $1 million into a school, you're going to get $11 million over the next 20 years out of that school in terms of increased productivity. It's an 11-to-1 return on investment. Most infrastructure produces anywhere from a 200 to a 2,000% return on investment. So we just need to do it. Max, thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the two traditional ways to do it are you either borrow to do it, and over the long term you get that money back and increase tax revenue, or you increase taxes to do it. But we could do both. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the syndicating companies that carry our program out to radio stations, television stations, and the world. Dial Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, CRN Network on cable systems all over the country, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, the folks at the American Forces Radio, and the folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program and however you are hearing or seeing this program. Please let them know that you appreciate it. You would not believe how important just, you know, one phone call a year, just calling up a sponsor or a radio station or a TV station or a cable system or a network and just saying, you know, really appreciate that Tom Hartman program. Or whatever other programming that you like. I could just tell you, I'm inside the business. They so rarely get this kind of positive feedback. Everybody, you know, gets all upset when Rush Limbaugh says something terrible. But very rarely do people ever say thank you for something. And well, everybody gets all upset when I say something terrible. But if you've got a thank you and you consider it. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You've heard a new theory about global warming, really?
No, absolutely not. What I heard, and by the way, I appreciate you and your show.
Thank you.
No, I was flipping through the AM radio station. I came across this conservative Christian sort of talk that was going on, and I happened to listen to it for a little bit. And a caller called in and was basically asking, you know, how to be a good steward for the environment, you know, kind of concerned about, you know, some of the climate crisis. And this guy basically said that, the earth is warming up because we're allowing gay people to get married and that we're living a life of sin and that God put all these natural resources on the planet for us to use and utilize to our wildest imagination and it just kind of makes me think about just what we're up against, you know, in this war.
It sounds, Marty, like we're up against stupid. I mean, how does gay people warm up the planet? What is it, excessive friction? I mean, I don't get it.
I don't understand it either, not even in the slightest bit, but I guess God's mad, so he's heating up the world, so he's invoking hate.
Hell is getting closer. Is that what it is? You know, it's coming up from the bottom of the earth, and pretty soon it's going to break through at Yellowstone National Park, and poor Yogi Bear. Marty, thanks for sharing that story. That's a hoot. Russ, listening to WHMP in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. Hey, Russ.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
I wanted to call and talk about the debate on gun control and some thoughts I have on background checks and things. Very frustrating to me. I have these thoughts and never have heard them discussed, brought up anywhere. A couple things. Okay, we know some people have one or two guns. Some people have arsenals, 50 guns, maybe more.
Mm.
What happens to all those guns when the person dies?
They become part of the estate and they get sold.
Pardon?
They become part of the estate and they get either handed down to heirs or they get sold.
Yeah, but my point is that the person who bought them passed the background check when he got them, but now they're being distributed freely to whoever's there.
Right.
And also the fact that the person may pass the background check, but 30 years down the line, he develops dementia. And he's still got his guns.
Right.
I wonder if that's got something to do with what happened to this guy that held this little kid for a while.
Yeah.
If it was something like that.
Well, this plays into and apparently six states now are considering legislation that would require liability insurance for guns. But it gets to the issue that I keep making, and there's a real simple framing device for this. And that is that if those 20 children who died in Newtown, Connecticut had been hit by a drunk driver or by a street full of drunk drivers, they would be receiving millions of dollars in insurance payments because of the liability insurance that all drivers in Connecticut are required to carry. If you own a car and you drive a car, you have to have liability insurance for you and for that car. And if gun owner and but because they were killed by a person with a gun, they're getting literally nothing. They're not getting bupkis. They're not even getting enough money to bury their own kids, much less for the counseling that they're going to need to hold their families together and you know, loss of income from the time that they're spending dealing with all of that. Nothing. They're getting bupkis. We should deal with guns in the same rational, non-pejorative, non-judgmental, non-discriminatory way that we deal with cars. We don't say, oh, we want fewer cars, therefore we're going to require registration insurance and proof of proficiency. Instead, we simply say cars can kill people. You know, we discovered this in the 1920s. Before the 1920s, there was no requirement for insurance, there was no requirement for a driver's license, and there was no registration of vehicles. And starting in the late 20s and through the 1930s, as cars got faster and faster and there were more and more of them on the road, the first consensus about red, green, yellow lights, that was in the 1930s. The first stop signs were in the 1920s. And over that period of time, as cars went from being an oddity to being a norm to being very common, we said, register them, prove that you know how to drive them, and be insured. We need to do the same thing with guns. It's really simple.
My point is that with all the talk about background checks, these are real weaknesses in the background check.
I agree. I think the registration, proof of proficiency, which could include a background check, by the way. I mean, you know, you go in to get a driver's license and they look at your record and find out you got five you know, drunk driving convictions, they're not going to give you a driver's license. So it could be part of that. And but you know, a shooter's license, as it were, a gun owner's license, and insurance. Let's just deal with them like cars. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman Program, we'll have the latest on the approaching sequester deadline, along with the important news and information from the weekend, plus more on modern monetary theory and how it could possibly save America and the world with Dr. Stephanie Kelton. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It ain't a spectator sport. Get out there and occupy something like the Democratic Party. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.